Tonight on Arena, Pauline Black, singer with The Selector, on the new documentary about her life in music, and we review Owen McNamee's new book, The Bureau. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. On My Radio by The Selector, with the distinctive voice of its lead singer Pauline Black, who gave high energy performances while fronting the band dressed in distinctive suit, trilby hat and loafers. Pauline had a difficult upbringing as an adopted mixed race child in a white English family, but things changed when she became part of the two-tone music movement in 1979. Two-tone Records was a label founded in 1979 by Jerry Damers of The Specials. It promoted music that merged Jamaican ska with reggae and punk. As the iconic lead singer of the multiracial The Selector, Pauline was then able to explore and express many aspects of herself. The new documentary, Pauline Black, A Two-Tone Story, is now showing on Sky, and it's based on Pauline's book, Black by Design. I'm absolutely delighted to be joined on Arena this evening by Pauline Black. Good to have you with us, Pauline, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's good to be here, Sean. Thank you for having me.
I'm just thinking about, you know, how The Selector was part of this two-tone movement, that fusion, as I say, of Jamaican ska, reggae and punk, and the whole new wave scene in Britain of the time. But, of course, the title of the documentary, Pauline Black, A Two-Tone Story. Two-tone had a different, very different meaning here, I think, for you personally, particularly in your early childhood, which, well, I'll let you tell us a little bit about what it was like being that young mixed-race child growing up in a very white Essex.
Well, I think, I mean, A Two-Tone Story, we called it that because it works on both levels by the fact of, you know, The Selector was part of the two-tone movement, which started in 1979. And myself, as a mixed-race person, you could say, I am two-tone in that respect. And I was born in an unmarried mother's home in 1953, and I was adopted, I was fostered first at 4 weeks old, but that family adopted me when I was 18 months old. And if anyone has ever been to Romford in Essex, they will know that, and were around, obviously, in 1953, which is probably not everybody that's listening, they will know that it was probably not the most liberal of places to rock up. There I was, basically. And they had to tell me that I was adopted before I started school because, you know, I was the only black kid in the school during sort of all of my school years. So it was, yeah, it was relatively difficult in that respect. And plus the fact that the family that I was adopted into held many of the sort of casual racist ideas that everybody pretty much did in the UK at that time. You know, if you went to London, you would find those wonderful signs that sort of said, you know, no blacks, no Irish, no dogs. It was not really, really good for anyone who was of, you know, had immigrated into the place or was just seen as different. And therefore you get into that whole situation of othering. And once you're othered, it's kind of a two-pronged thing. I mean, you can see it as a really bad thing, but I tended to see it as quite a good thing because I had a ringside seat, if you like, as a little black girl in those days, to exactly what people said to each other about people of, you know, a different colour to them.
I have to say,
not pretty.
No, I would say, because, I mean, we're talking about there were family, extended family members who were connected to the National Front. We're talking about people with very serious racist opinions at that time. But I was very taken by the fact that you, that as you've just stated it there, because you say it in the documentary as well, that you felt that being othered, actually, it's almost as if you say it was a kind of, you were put in the position of privilege of being the outsider who could see things. How observant a young child were you? You know, how many notes were you taking in your young head? And how did they feed into your later years then when, as a teenager, you moved to Coventry?
I was, once you are put in the position of knowing that you're adopted and knowing that maybe the things that the family feel, not towards me, and they were a very loving family, I cannot say that they weren't. And that's really the contradiction, if you like. You know, you're sort of sitting there within that contradiction. You know, you mentioned my Uncle Will, for instance, who worked on the railways. He was, you know, did the signal. He was a signal man at Sheffield. And he really thought that Enoch Powell had the right idea, that the things that he was saying about people who were coming into the country and all those kinds of things, ostensibly to, as many Irish people did as well, to work in the NHS, was not a good thing. But of course, you know, if he ever went to the doctor or whatever, he might have been seen by a doctor of color, and he would be very, you know, wouldn't be very happy about it. So there's all these things going on, and I'm seeing that. I'm hearing them talking about it. That's not to be divisive. It is to be, I suppose, you know, you're trying to sort things out, aren't you, when you're growing up? You're trying to sort out where you fit into everything, where other people fit into them, what you should be thinking, what you shouldn't be thinking. Are you at odds with the society that you're actually living in? And if so, how much so? So all of that was, I was quite an observant child.
And I suppose being in a situation like that and listening and looking at what was going on around you was inevitably going to feed into the music that came later on. But you mentioned the NHS there, and in fact you went to Coventry to study to become a radiographer, which you did succeed in doing. And I think, I don't know if you still practice those skills, but you did practice those skills for quite a long time, in terms of the early stages of your music career. But the Coventry that you went to, Pauline Black, in 19, was it, when was it, 1970, 19,
It was
1980?
1971.
1971, beg your pardon.
I actually went to Coventry University there to study biochemistry, but I dropped out after 2 years for various reasons and ended up on a radiography course and then worked in the local NHS at a
But
place called Walsgrave Hospital.
somewhere along the line, you were seeing, I think, a very different society around you, a much more varied society all around you than you had ever seen in Essex, and you were hearing music like you'd never heard before.
Well, exactly. I mean, this was the hub of the car industry. So, a lot of people who had immigrated into this country from both the Caribbean and from, at that time, Ugandan Asians, as people were called, or Kenyan Asians, had also come here and had settled here in various areas around Coventry. And Coventry is a very welcoming city. You know, it's built on peace and reconciliation because of what happened that was so catastrophic here during the war. And so people were finding work here and jobs here. But of course, 1979, which was pretty much when Two Tone started, all of that just broke apart. And you'd got the advent of Margaret Thatcher's Conservative government and, you know, the decimation of the trade unions and also the decimation, really, of the car industry in this place. But just prior to 1979, I think we were living in really a cultural melting pot here. And out of that cultural melting pot came both us and the Specials. And it wasn't just here. I mean, you know, in Birmingham, which is only 25 miles up the road, you've got people like Dex's Midnight Runners. You've got people like, you know, The Beat, and UB40, of course. You know, I mean, we're all kind of swimming in the same pool, as it were.
And
And
it was interesting to me that in some ways, you know, you had the wonderful rhythms, those kind of slightly offbeat rhythms of reggae and Jamaican style music and ska, and mixed in with this, the political agitation of punk music. Let's have a listen to one of your songs from a little bit later. We're in 1980, I think, when we get 3 Minute Hero.
Three minute hero.
Just a little section there of 3 Minute Hero from the Selector, Pauline Black, singer with that band, is with me this evening, speaking about documentary that is currently showing on Sky, which tells her story and indeed the story of two-tone music of the time. Really taking, I just love, you know, it describes everything so well. It's 5 p.m. and you're on your way home, just another day with that endless grey drone. And the singer goes on to describe 11 p.m. on the following morning and it's the same grey drone no matter where you go. That lyric, that kind of political statement, the plight of many young men and women at the time, and who may have been searching for jobs, many of them, in fact, never mind going to and from jobs, that would have spoken right across the social divide from punk, white punk, you know, young men who were full of anger at some of your gigs, I believe, right across to all kinds of members of society.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was very much steeped in kind of a working class ethic. In terms of the fact that, you know, you're working from paycheck to paycheck, basically. And there's very little going on in a lot of the cities in the Midlands. It's all very well if you're in London, you know, the hub of where everything's supposed to go on. I mean, it wasn't the same at all in places like Coventry. I mean, the whole point of 3 Minute Hero was, I suppose, the yearning to become a 3 Minute Hero. It was to make a 3 Minute pop song. Yeah. Which is how long, you know, records, when they had records, you know, 7 inches and things like that, were, you know, if you held that in your hand, that was something that you had a real passion about. Yeah. And that was when records sold by the, you know, tens of thousands, I mean, hundreds of thousands to get you to number one. And it really meant something. It really meant something to a young person to have done that.
Yeah, and to have chosen to spend their money, go to the record shop and spend what little money they have
exactly
on that specific record. But I'm interested in, you know, this idea that you describe at one point, I don't know if it's a specific gig, where there were, like, because there was such enmity between the anti-Nazi League and lots of the members of the, who, what we might call the punk movement or young followers of punk music. But there was an interesting way in which they behaved before your gigs and then when the music started. You might describe that to us.
Well, it wasn't so much punks, I don't think. I mean, we never, ever had much of a problem with punks at all. I mean,
there was
a huge crossover between punks and reggae. Mm. We all knew that, you know, in one way or another, you were sort of, it was an anti-establishment thing. There's always been this rather strange contradiction between the more kind of fascist skinheads, if I can use that word, and the regular skinheads who just enjoy reggae music, particularly 60s, late 50s reggae music, Prince Buster, the Scatterlights, all of those people. That led to, you know, sections of the skinhead community deciding that there was just too many black people in a band for them. I mean, I think they used to call us the Selector Plus One. So if anyone looks at a photo and they can kind of figure out the maths there, I think the Specials were known as the Specials Plus Two. So you know that you're on a bit of a back foot there. Yeah. And you better be good on stage, quite apart from anything else. But yes, I mean, that was a bit difficult. You know, being Zeke Heil, that is a fairly unpleasant thing.
Yeah, because the Nazi salute would be shouted up at you before the gig would start.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, you learn to navigate those kind of things. I mean, I am not one who wishes to preach to the converted, you know, otherwise I'd go away and be a hippie somewhere or something, or would have done.
Yeah.
You know, that really wasn't my bag. I mean, I really liked that kind of, you know, that front line, that kind of interface between us and, if you like, the enemy. I mean, they turned up. They loved the music.
That was
but
the
they
thing.
Just didn't like, they didn't like very much the people who played it.
This, I mentioned earlier, Pauline, about the style. I mean, when I look at some of the outfits that you wore, it was, you were so stylish. at that time, with the trilby hat, with the suit, and with the loafers, how important was that look, do you think, to what you were saying?
I think it was that look, that kind of androgynous look, that rude boy, rude girl thing going on. I think, as Don Letts says in the film, that it's it was easily accessible to everybody. You would find, because it was like 25 years later after the first round of people kind of doing that whole mod skinhead thing, you could find in Oxfam shops and all those kinds of secondhand shops, you could find quite a lot of clothes, Brutus shirts, Stay Press, tonic suits, loafers, all of that. So people could buy into that style without having to spend loads and loads of money. It was much more expensive to go down the King's Road, and sort out, even if you could manage all the abuse, probably that sort of, got hurled at you if you went into a Vivienne Westwood shop or something,
Fair
like you
enough.
weren't cool enough or something like this. You could do that. There was something quite egalitarian about it.
I'm always also interested in a moment that's picked out in the documentary where a very famous photograph, which was on the NME, if I remember right, Susie Sue, Chrissie Hynde, polystyrene, Debbie Harry of Blondie, and yourself. You talk about, I think it's yourself that talks about the specifics of how yourself and polystyrene didn't. What was that day like for you? Because there is a difference in the two of you in that picture from the others.
Well, I mean, we were both women of color at that time. We both, I think, without actually ever having to say it, because you do tend to sort of develop a shorthand of looks between you. When you find yourself in a situation, you think, how the hell did I get here? Debbie Harry, very, very sweet woman. We had played with Blondie at Hammersmith, Odeon as it was then, it's the Apollo now. And very generous, but she decided that was going to be her tea party. That's how she remembers it. Anyway, I actually don't remember it like that. We were kind of waiting around for Debbie to turn up for quite a long time. And there were probably a few too many bottles of wine there, so, which might have something to do with it. But I mean, it was supposed to be a grouping of, the women of the moment in rock. So it was fantastic to sit around, and be able to talk to Chrissie Hynde and all those things. But then it was like, here is the photo session. It all depends on that photo, and that's what's remembered, not
Yeah, of
the interview
course. Not not
or
not not what you
whatever.
said.
Exactly.
I want to
So that was a bit more difficult. That was a
Yeah.
bit more difficult, yeah.
I want to finish up by talking a little bit. Obviously, the documentary deals with your musical career and gives us a very good sense of the political context of the time, the musical context of the time as well. But it also deals with your own search for your birth mother and birth father. I don't know how much you want to tell us of that, but it might be a way of setting up the track that is used at the very end, over the closing credits of the documentary. I just thought there was something beautiful in the way the final moments spoke to that final track that you use.
I think that, well, the track that we're talking about is actually called Human Algebra. And somehow, I don't know. I mean, I've reached the age that I have reached, and it is very much like, aren't we? We're all on this planet. We're all human beings, but there's something kind of algebraic about it, because I was never very good at algebra at school. And a lot of people aren't. It's just sort of like a foreign language or whatever. And it's, we have to navigate, don't we, through humanity. And sometimes it's quite hard to do that. And to go and find your birth mother at 42, which is what I did, and by extension, my birth father, and to deal with all that, it really did feel like some huge algebraic equation. And and I found a magnificent woman who I feel was like many of those women who had babies when they were quite young. She had me at 17. We're kind of pioneers out there on the frontier. And taking all the reprobation of society at the time, and many of those institutions that they ended up in, mother and baby homes, were church run, or certainly had those kinds of values. And so it was very, very difficult for them. And she, her, in the end, I found her in Australia, and it just felt like that somehow, you know, like fighting your way through this. And now I suppose now I've got to the end of it, I can just say QED.
Yeah, I was going to say, you finally solved the equation,
Yes.
possibly the only algebraic equation you solved in your life, but you solved this one.
I did.
Pauline Black, thank you so much for speaking with us this evening. It's been lovely speaking with you.
Thank you very much, Sean. Thank you for having me.
And we will finish with human algebra. Human Algebra, the title of that track from The Selector, a wonderful chorus, Mama So Blue, so potent as performed there by singer Pauline Black, who was speaking with us before that track about the documentary Pauline Black, A Two-Tone Story, which is available on Sky Arts from this Wednesday, April 16th. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Ryan Coogler is the Oscar-nominated director of films like Black Panther and Creed. And on Friday, his latest film, Sinners, opens in Irish cinemas. The film is set in the Mississippi Delta in the 1930s when Jim Crow laws were at their zenith and blues music had emerged as a powerful cultural phenomenon. The film stars Coogler's frequent collaborator, Michael B. Jordan, in the dual role of the Smokestack Twins, criminals who have returned to their home place with a fistful of cash and a plan to open a juke joint. Musician Miles Caton plays the twins' cousin Sammy, a character whose story holds echoes of the legendary blues man Robert Johnson, who is said to have sold his soul to the devil at a crossroads. With this in mind, it's not surprising that along with the Delta Blues, the supernatural plays a major role in the film Sinners in the form of the terrifying Remick, a vampire with a talent for bluegrass and indeed a little bit of Shannos. He's played by Jack O'Connell. Sinead Egan spoke to Ryan Coogler and his collaborator Ludvig Göransson, the Oscar-winning Icelandic composer who wrote the score for the film, consulting indeed at one point with her own Éire O'Linnard on some of the Irish music that appears in the score. Before we hear that conversation, let's hear a clip from the film, which is, after all is said and done, a vampire movie. In this scene, the occupants of the new juke joint are trying to distinguish dead from undead.
What y'all doing? Just step aside and let me on in now.
Why you need him to do that? You big and strong enough to push past us?
Well, that wouldn't be too polite now, would it, Miss Annie? I don't know why I'm talking to you anyway. Smoke.
Don't talk to him. You talking to me right now. Why you can't just walk your big ass up in here without an invite, huh? Go ahead. Admit to it.
Admit to what?
That you dead.
Smoke, you listening to this? Now we out here playing games, telling ghost stories in place of doing what we ought to do.
And what is it we supposed to be doing?
Being kind to one another and being polite. Now we is one people, and we shouldn't go in barging into other folks' places uninvited. So. You've been in and out of here all day. Ain't never need an invite then. Yeah, something ain't adding up. Can I at least get my money?
Careful.
Ryan Coogler, Ludvig Göransson, welcome to Arena. Ryan, where did the story for Sinners come from?
It came from my relationship with my Uncle James Emerson, who was for a large portion of my life, the oldest male member of my family. Most of my family immigrated to California, or migrated, I should say, because they came from within the state, but they migrated to California from Port Arthur, Texas, which is around the Gulf of Mexico in Texas. But a few select male members of my family came from Mississippi. My maternal grandfather was one of them. He died right before I was born, so I never met him. But my Uncle James was another one of them. He married my grandmother's younger sister, Sammy, who is where I got the character's name from. And he loved blues music. He would play it all the time, and I would listen to it when I was with him. And after he passed away in 2015, I would often find myself listening to those same records whenever I was thinking about him. And that act of kind of using music to heal my grief and to kind of conjure the memory of my uncle, you know, is what gave birth to the idea behind this film.
And watching it, Ryan, it's hard not to think about the story of the blues singer Robert Johnson as well, who's said to have sold his soul to the devil in order to become an incredible blues performer. And the film is certainly steeped in this sense of the transformative power of Delta blues music.
No, absolutely. We in research, I also found that story of Robert Johnson, that's often only attributed to him. It actually came from a guitarist that was before him, a guy named Tommy Johnson. He was the first guy to tell that story. And Robert Johnson kind of co-opted that story, you know, and just that realization that so much of what we know about the blues has been kind of comes from a culture where people borrow from the people that came before them. You know, it really inspired me to you know, explore that concept in the film.
Something I've been wanting to tell you for a long time. It might hurt you, hope you don't lose your mind. Well, I was just a boy, about 8 years old. You threw me a Bible on that Mississippi road. See, I love you, Papa, you did all you could do. And they say the truth hurts, so I lied to you. Yes, I lied to you.
What kind of traditions and artists were you immersed in for your work on Sinners?
It's interesting because I grew up with a dad who was really into the blues, and his hero was the Greek guitar player Albert King, and so I always had the Three Kings in my ear when I grew up: Albert King, B.B. King, and Freddie King. And being able to, but. I kind of needed my own personality and my own sound. So when I was 9 years old, I heard Metallica for the first time. And for me, that was like, okay, my dad has the blues. I'm going to be the, you know, heavy metal guy. Not at that time realizing how obvious it was, and that heavy metal, like everything that it comes from the blues, you know. And so for me, it was that experience of actually just what I just talked about, and that journey from metal to blues and everything in between, showcasing that in the score.
Ludwig, there are moments, and I won't give away when in the film, but there are traditional Irish songs performed on screen, which was exciting to see from my perspective. And in fact, the actor Jack O'Connell, who plays this shady Remick character, says it attracted him to the role. How did you select these Irish songs and set about weaving them into the overall sound of the film?
Ryan always had the Rocky Road to Dublin was in the script. And my music producing partner and wife Serena, her dad's Irish, and so it was very important, especially, and also you know, it was very important to get that music right. And I think it was Serena and Jack O'Connell had a conversation about
Go Lassie Go.
Go Lassie Go.
Yeah, Jack suggested it. He actually suggested it to me first, because what I wrote in the script was a Spearish Mountain song. I always thought that Remick's true origins like would be revealed, like kind of peeled back like an onion. And I had imagined it being like an Appalachian song that they would sing in that scene where you hear, but I didn't specify what song it was. Like I wrote a Spanish Mountain song. And then Jack called me and he said, "Hey man, can I suggest a song?"
Trees are sweetly blooming. Grows around the blooming heather. Will you go, lassie, go?
And we'll all go together to Bowhile Mountain time. All around the blooming heather. Will you go, lassie, go?
I will build my love.
And Jack's whole performance was kind of dedicated to his father, who was a Irish man who immigrated to the UK.
Yeah.
And passed away when Jack was a young adult. That was when I realized that Jack was like the only person for this role because, you know, I was making this movie as a love letter to my uncle, to this man who was from another place that was so important, you know, to my life. And researching the Delta blues scene, you know, Choctaw people contributed to that music. Irish Americans contributed to that music. You know, as African Americans, we've always seen a kinship to Irish people. You know what I mean? And always have appreciated the culture. And I think it's a mutual kinship. You know what I mean? When he shared that with me about his relationship with his father and his performance, all of his art and his decision making coming from that place, you know, it was a place where we connected because everything for me was coming from my, you know, my love for my uncle. And when he picked that song, he was like, "Is it appropriate for me to suggest it?" I was like, "Man, absolutely! You know, it has to be that song."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and then when I heard it, you know, I was just blown away.
I can also just add that we were also able to, on the for the Rocky Road to Dublin, we were able to work with an incredible Shano singer in Ireland named Yarla Leonard, who helped us kind of arrange that magical intro that Jack is singing, kind of making it in. You know, into a very beautiful emotional statement.
Then off to reap the corn and leave where I was born. I cut a stout black thorn for to banish ghosts and goblins. A brand new pair of brogues to rattle over the box and frighten all the dogs on the rocky road to Dublin. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, in the merry month of May, from me home I started, left the girls of Tuam were nearly broken-hearted, saluted father dear, kissed me darling mother, drank a pint of beer, my grief in tears to smother, then off to reap the corn, leave where I was born, cut a stout black thorn to banish ghosts and goblins, brand new pair of brogues, rattling over the bogs and frightened all the dogs, on the rocky road to Dublin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hunt the hare and turn her down the rocky road, and all the way to Dublin, what for lolly-da.
And Ryan, this is your first foray into the horror genre. What attracted you to this medium as a way to tell this story, which is also so immersed in the blues?
That's a great question. Well, first, the first thing is that the blues is very heavily associated with the metaphysical. It's heavily associated with mysticism and superstition. And to be an African American is to be associated with those things. You know, we come from a very spiritual people, you know, even before we hit the Americas, you know, through being enslaved and forcibly removed, you know, and placed into that system. The superstitions are kind of like a thing that's constant with us. So to make a movie about the blues, you have to reckon with that. The other thing is, like, I wanted to bring myself to this because so often I've made, you know, films that existed in the context that the audiences were familiar with, that were outside of me, be it a true story or a film that takes place in a Rocky franchise or a comic book adaptation. You know, I hadn't really shown audiences what I truly like and value in narratives, you know what I mean? Which is, you know, I'm a product of the late 80s, or, you know, 1990s. You know, I read Goosebumps books, you know, about a truckload. You know, I read Stephen King about a truckload and came up, you know, really loving horror as a fiction genre, you know, in books and in movies. So I wanted to kind of merge, you know, that part of myself, you know, with this story. And as I researched it more and more, I realized that it just made a ton of sense. And we went forward from there.
Well, Ryan Coogler, Ludvig Göransson, thank you so much for speaking to Arena this evening.
Okay.
The crickets do.
Yes, you see, if you want your soundtrack to come to life, get your actress to perform it for you. That was actress Jamie Lawson there with her rendition of Pale Pale Moon from the soundtrack to Sinners, which I must say sounds incredible. I'll certainly be seeking it out. The film itself opens in cinemas on Friday, and before that music you heard Sinead Egan speaking to director Ryan Coogler and composer Ludvig Göransson. The Bureau is Owen McNamee's eighth novel and his most personal yet. His first book, Resurrection Men, took as its subject the Shankill Butchers, a notorious loyalist gang who operated in the north of Ireland in the late 1970s. Since then, he has continued to explore real-life violence and sudden death in heightened, moody prose to, quote, deepen the mystery, as he himself has said. In his new novel, Owen McNamee brings us to the border in the 1990s to a story that involves his own father, Brendan, former solicitor who has set up a bureau de change in Newry that's doing a lot more than changing punt for sterling. Paula Shields has been reading the bureau for us and she joins me now. It's something that Owen McNamee does, Paula, taking the reader into these places that we can't usually get inside in any kind of realistic way, whether that's the awfulness of the Shankill Butchers in the 1970s or the 1950s Ulster High Society judge Lance Curran and his family in the Blue Tango trilogy. It's a peculiar mix of kind of fiction, non-fiction, a lot of real events here. I think, who was it? Connor Curran, is that his name? Yeah, Connor O'Callaghan, sorry, in his Irish Times Review, we talked about it's not so much fictionalising these events as mythologising them, which is exactly what he's doing here as well.
Absolutely, because there are place names you'll recognise and specific hotels or roads in Drogheda or Dundalk, and interviews mentioned with Vincent Brown at one point. So it's like he kind of needs these things and embeds them in a kind of terrain that we know, and yet everything is heightened. We're in a liminal space, really, on this border. It's a kind of no man's land. Mm. And he does this every time he goes into, whether it's the Blue Tango trilogy that you're talking about in the 1950s in the north, a very kind of posh Agatha Christie type setup almost, yeah, except it's real. It's real. And things like
that. And it's a lot darker than Agatha Christie, it has to be said.
Indeed it is. And then with Resurrection Man, it's the Shankill Butchers. Like, in some ways, any of us who grew up during the Troubles were trained by osmosis almost not to talk about any of this stuff. Mm. And yet Owen goes to the page. And I think he'd be the last to say this, but there's a kind of courage to what he does as well in naming these things. Like, Dominic McGlinchey turns up in this book, Mad Dog Dominic McGlinchey. And these people aren't, they're dead now, but they're not likely written about still.
Yeah, and he manages to do it in a way that neither exploits the awfulness of some of the events that happened or glorifies, even though I've mentioned that mythologizing thing, he doesn't mythologize people who have committed terrible acts of violence. They don't become big heroes.
No, and he manages not to judge. It's like he brings us into them. And even here, we have no, there's no moralizing. And so there's no, I mean, we see human faces, but he isn't glamorizing them.
Glamorizing is exactly the word. That is what he doesn't do, and quite right not to. The starting point for The Bureau, this latest novel, you kind of think, how do writers get whatever he has here, a 230 page book out of a little fragment of an actual letter?
And stories through his childhood as well. There's a letter from one of the main characters in this book is Paddy Farrell, and he's a drug dealer and he's a pretty nasty guy, but we see him mostly through his girlfriend Lorraine, who is very smitten. But he's writing a letter from Cork Prison in 1982-83 to Brendan McNamee, and Owen says, it's like a prologue in a way.
Yeah.
He says, this is a real fragment. And in a way, it's the blandest of the bland.
Because Brendan McNamee is Owen McNamee's father.
Yes, and he was a solicitor who was struck off because he was caught defrauding, or he was, I think it might have been disputed later on, defrauding clients. He was a gambler, he had a gambling problem. But it's a very bland letter, and it says, tell Larry also, he can drop me a line if there's any queries regarding anything. And you think, here we are, we're in the land of the slippery customer, whatever you say, say nothing. But at the end, Owen says, The letter is the only evidence. And then he says, some stories seem to tell themselves and other stories wish to remain untold. It is uncertain which this is. And in a way, I feel there's a kind of tension between the story you're telling and the story you're not telling that is very intriguing all the way through the story of Paddy and Lorraine Farrell and the story of Brendan McNamee as it comes out in the Bureau.
And Lorraine and Paddy Farrell are found dead in Lorraine's mother's home in Drogheda. Is that a real event?
Yes, not something that I'd heard of. And it has all the kind of hallmarks of a kind of tabloid newspaper story. Mm. So it's 1997. And so we go from this fragment of a letter straight into the lovers are found dead naked in a bedroom. And it looks like she has shot Paddy and then turned the gun on herself. But, you know, it's in a little terrace overlooking Lourdes Hospital. It's very specific about where it all unfolds. Mm. So we know their outcome from the beginning, and then we go back to when they first meet in a hotel via Brendan. So in a way, we know they're doomed from the start, and we don't know why. We don't know why.
And the people of the border area now can forgive me this one. I am a border boy myself, so I'm possibly allowed to say it. But there is something about that particular terrain, Drogheda into Louth, up through Ravensdale, across into Newry, South Armagh and over towards Monaghan, has a similar type of feel to it. Is it, you mentioned this idea of the liminal space, but Owen McNamee describes the slipperiness of that particular part of the island in a very specific way.
He does. That terrain really is its own character. And so we're in the world of, you know, the RUC and British Army checkpoints and helicopters, and yet there's no physical border as such. It is like we're in a no man's land or some other strange, he talks about strange terrain, unsolid, ghosted through. So it is like some sort of netherworld we're in. And one of the things that Lorraine likes, I mean, she's a fascinating character. She goes to mass, but she likes these criminals. You know, to her, going on the M1, which is the road you and I would use, is the road of convention. And she loves the back roads. She sees them as Bonnie and Clyde. But it is a place apart. It is permanently kind of twilight. You know, everything is grey, everything is murky, illicit. You're not supposed to be here, he says at one point.
Yeah, and we shouldn't really be looking at this, I suppose, is one of the ideas of what the book is saying to us. Mm-hmm. The Bureau de Change, that again brings up a very specific period when, you know, when the punt broke from Stirling, and therefore if you wanted to cross the border and you wanted to do business on one or other side, you had to change your punts for Stirling or your Stirling for punts, as the case may be. What kind of Bureau de Change does Brendan McNamee run?
Well, Owen McNamee has described his father as clever but not shrewd. And this is apparently the first Bureau de Change that was ever set up, and it's set up on a street in Newry. Mm. And so he does have the idea that this is back in the days of banks. It's not tapping cards to pay things. No. It really feels like travelling in time.
Oh, you had to have
like
cash or traveller's cheques.
The 90s are history now, which takes some getting used to. But so he sets up the Bureau de Change, and of course, it's a rented shop front. It's a front for laundering money for all kinds of undesirables.
Nefarious activity, yeah.
So it attracts all kinds of customers and all kinds of characters.
Yeah, and you mentioned already Dominic McGlinchey, the so-called Dominic Mad Dog McGlinchey. Mm-hmm. I think one of the scenes that stands out for you in the book, is it a visit by Paddy and Lorraine to the McGlinchey household, or is it just Paddy who goes there?
It's very much the two of them.
Yeah.
And what it is, so I'm already, you know, admiring of Owen's bravery, and then pretty quickly Dominic McGlinchey turns up, and it's to do with, again, something that actually happened, a tiger kidnapping and a robbery of an American Express on Grafton Street in Dublin. So Dominic McGlinchey's involved. So is Brendan in the background. You know, he knows what's going to happen. He's part of the operation somehow. But afterwards, they steal cash and they steal travellers' cheques, which was the point of the thing. And afterwards, Paddy and Lorraine are dispatched to this semi-derelict two-storey farmhouse in the wilds that Dominic and Mary McGlinchey are living in. She's as tough a character as Dominic, Mary McGlinchey. It's a fascinating portrait of the two of them. But of course, it takes place at night. They're going to pick up the traveller's cheques and the cash. And in the middle of it all, this is a rented farmhouse. Mary says, "You didn't put the geese in." Mm. So Dominic goes up the fields in the dark, Lorraine with him, and the geese are all lying dead. And they've been got at by mink. Dominic already knows, because he says if it was a fox only kills what it needs to eat. Whereas the mink, and she says to Dominic, which are you? Now, he doesn't really answer. But of course, the striking thing about the whole thing is she waits to feel afraid of him and she doesn't. And Mary McGlinchey, who's as tough as old nails, warns Paddy that there's a hint of death around Lorraine. Yeah. Like she says there's something unholy in that girl.
Yeah, and he manages somehow on McNamee to leave what may or may not have happened in that room where the two bodies are found. He leaves that ambiguous for us. But I'm interested in, he is dealing with his own father here, mm-hmm. in the character of, I'm calling him a character, but he was Owen McNamee's father, Brendan, mm-hmm. McNamee. How does he handle that, and how does it work throughout the book?
Well, you know, as I said, he doesn't really judge. But we meet Brendan is sitting at the bar. He's very smart. He's in command. He can talk to everybody. He's a wheeler dealer. Mm. At one point, the fictional son called Owen, which Owen has said is an amalgam of himself and his brother, is kidnapped. And Owen writes, you'd want to think he threw everything at it when it came to finding his, now his brother lived, but his brother was interrogated, mm-hmm. a bag put over his head, because Brendan got into hot water. He was a gambler. He gambled £700,000 30 years ago
of
other
money.
People's money, yeah. The worst sort. And of course they came looking for him, and they, you know, and yeah. There's no sense, like, he's a fascinating character, but my God, he's no sense of a reasonable
It sounds like a dark read, but is it fascinating for all of that? Because you've talked about fascinating characters. Is the read worth it?
It is. It's gripping. I find the prose sparer than, not as lyrical, not as poetic, but still brilliant. I mean, he writes beautifully and nobody can do what he does. So I was more than happy to charge through it.
Charge through. The Bureau is the book that Paula Shields has been speaking to us about. It's written by Owen McNamee and it's published by River Run.